Can you appreciate how the assignments that we're working with now are royal roads right into the center of this activity? The sculpture, the painting, the new kind of mask, the haiku. If you can bring to balance those four assignments together, if you bring those to balance, I work with this a long time, that sense of internal presence will be there. It will be there. Not because I put it there, because it is there. So Moore, working with the Chalk Mool, realized there's something about the relationship of art to nature. A work of art has a protean relationship with nature, very much like man as man has with nature. And I think the only way to really express it is William Blake's Glad Day, where he has man and the aura of man just flashing out. It's like when man is real, the whole universe is real. Man makes the light manifest. When a human being is, everything has its value. Everything is calibrated to be worth it. It's like that kind of a vision. And Moore saw that his sculpture could be moved to an even more protean level with the Chalk Mool. And the key for him was that now space, his space, his artistic understanding of space, had a link to water. So that space and water, and Moore's artistic conception changed, and he saw that sculpture is no longer limited to being put into a museum or into a gallery or into a home, but that the true place of what he called monumental sculpture was outside. Outside the building, even in the countryside. That sculpture, in a monumental sense, can be developed to belong in nature, make nature resonant. And so from the Chalk Mool, this is the sculpture that he worked on. This is in front of the UN building in Paris. Now you can see all the themes that we've talked about. And you can see that somebody who just talks about volume and space and their interpenetration and so forth is missing Moore's distinctive sculpture, missing his art. That kind of language is interesting, but it's on an image level. The artist is real, a million miles beyond that level. It's a very primitive discursive level. That's hardly even worth talking about, although one has to begin there. But one has to carry it much further. And that's what we're after. We're after to be able to carry it much further. This is a detail. Notice a new element in Moore's UN Paris building sculpture. Notice now that the sinuousness of the form with its pretzel-like interpenetration folds space within the form. There are no longer opposites playing vis-a-vis a tension, but that the tension itself now carries the opposites together in one continuum. Incredible sophistication. Moore is a very great artist to have been able not only to see this, but to execute this. That sculpture is a continuum of space and volume brought back into a new modulation on the very highest level of abstraction. And he was always pleased that he was able to do this in front of the UN building in Paris, because he thought all the different kinds of humanity that come together from whatever perspective, from whatever culture, from whatever ethnocentricity they come from, if they can see this at all, they will all be able to see it together. Coming from their own ways, they'll be able to see this together. And it was a marvelous example. Just a few more and then we'll take a break. So he worked with the great interpenetration now, form and space in a continuum. And notice how form and time, the movement of form becomes like time. So you're working with a time-space continuum. I think this was one of the sculptures that led up to his sculpture very similar to this called Atomic Energy. But look at the scale that he's working on. There's more. He was about 5'10". So you've got a sculpture about 12 feet high, weighing somewhere in the vicinity of 4 or 5 tons. Notice the power of the artist to be able to work with this incredibly complex, multi-phased, abstract ideal, amplified and projected and now raised almost to heroic proportions. Notice, too, the messy studio. Yes. Here's an early Moore when he still was working with the opposition of space and form. Notice now what happens in the late works of Henry Moore. These are from the late 1970s. The spectator, the audience, the appreciator is now able to interplay with the forms and the spaces of the sculpture. Sculpture is so monumental that now human beings are able to interplay with it. Notice the level of amplified education going on, aesthetic education possible. Here is one of the ultimate developments of the rain space motif. The rain in Chak Mool was collected in a little dish on the side, almost the kind of a place where a cesarean operation would be made for a birth. Now, Moore in the late 20th century projected out. The rain has been collected in a way that is now the context for the whole sculpture. So that you get an enormous quantum leap in abstract expression. The abstract expressiveness becomes monumental. You not only have the work, but you have its reflection. The work's own reflection in its very context is now a part of the work. And in the reflection, one has not only the work, but one has the sky and whatever else of the landscape. One has nature brought into the work. The work becomes monumental. And this has, incidentally, an archaic self, deep self energy in it. Perhaps if I explain it this way, you'll get an insight into it. The earliest monumental structures in the world were made in the ancient, we call them today the British Isles, but in really archaic times, the earliest monumental structures were made. Like Newgrange was made about 3500 BC, that's 1,000 years before the pyramids of Cheops and Khafre. One of the great works at that time from that period of construction is called Silbury Hill. And it was not understood for an awful long time what its function was or what it was all about, because it was just a conical shaped hill, somewhat truncated on the top. And there was ground dug out and leveled out so that the hill stood out. It was definitely not a hill in nature, but a hill in something else. And about 20 years ago, a young British archaeology metaphysician named Michael Dent, puzzling over this, went to Silbury in an unseasonable time. He didn't go in the summer when most people go. But he went in the early spring to be alone with it and to just try and commit himself to the dam work. And as he was standing on the top of the conical hill, a tremendous rainstorm coming down, and he had a revelation. It was shown. Because around the hill where the earth had been scooped out, it filled up with water and made a lake. And he could see that the shape of the hill was the shape of a breast, and that he standing on the top was the nipple. Only from where he stood, being the nipple, he was also afloat in the sky, the whole hill, the whole breast, the whole Mother Earth, giving nourishment to man's visionary capacity. In the midst of the reflected stuff, suspended. And then he realized the one breast was the hill, the other the reflection. The man who comprehends is that point of nourishment. And here the Great Mother, in relationship to the sky, the Great Mother Earth, giving man the most precious of all gifts, the most invigorating of all nutrients, creative vision. To know that even in your suspended vision, you are real. You are a part of what Mother Earth is, of what Father Sky is, and of what the family of reality is. You are part of, you belong. And your comprehension is not some kind of fantasy outside of this realm, but it's the very symbolic bow where everything is tied. All the values come together. They all are attenuated there. Well, let's take a break and then we'll come back. Okay, better leave it on for a minute. You can get tapes of the first part of today and review it. And if you do a couple of times, I think the language should be tight enough to disclose a little more insight. This is a very special shot for me. It's not coming through so much because of the light, but that's all right. This is the midsummer sunrise coming over Henry Moore sculpture outside in England. It's a late 20th century Stonehenge. But whereas the original Stonehenge of 5,000 years ago was meant to ordinate man to the movement of the cosmos, this Henry Moore sculpture is meant to ordinate man to his inner cosmos. Our problem is not with the outer cosmos. Our problem is with the inner cosmos. Our problem is facing up to the fact that we are at a stage of exploration, which is just beginning. It's like 3,000 years ago, it was a very big thing to sail out of sight of land, and most navigation just hugged the coast. And it was a very big thing to go out of sight of land, a terrifying experience. And until navigation and a coordination of the stars and the movements of celestial bodies was made, it wasn't possible really to have confidence to be able to do that and maintain your direction, go where you wanted to go, across the water. We're in the same kind of tone in terms of interior space. We're still hugging the coast. and we're afraid to go out of sight of any familiarity. Only we live in a generation where we have to do that. We have to go out of sight of land inside. And the artists of the 20th century are the real guides for us, not the metaphysician, the artist. Because they cannot do what they do illegitimately. There's no such thing as a bogus great artist at all. So there's a kind of a primordiality to modern art. There's an affinity between the latest modern art, abstract art, and the most archaic art, ancient art, primitive art. And perhaps the person who recognized this fastest and most in the most protean way was Picasso, because Picasso didn't wait to think about something. He rushed in and started bowling things over and playing with things, irregardless of whether he understood. He didn't want to understand, he wanted to do. If you're nibbling a fish and the fish skeleton suddenly appeals to you, you begin making a work of art right there at the dinner table. Picasso was that kind of a protean figure, a matador with the terror. He loved the challenge. Bring it on. More terror. And so he recognized that primitive, so-called primitive art, and it's more apt to call it primordial art, has an affinity with abstract art. So I want to give you just a little bit of a photo essay for about 10 minutes so that you can begin to appreciate this. This is a mountain range in the middle of the Sahara Desert. There's a French name, Tassili d'Angers. And the peaks there go up to 11,200 feet, Imoukassi. 12,000 years ago, the Sahara was fertile. There are all sorts of freshwater lakes. It was a thriving civilization. There was no desert. It wasn't even the Sahel. It was a verdant grassland. And around the Tassili d'Angers mountain range was very high, sophisticated civilization. But because of the desiccation of the Sahara, because of the vacuity of any human habitation, the only people that go through this area are the Tuaregs, who migrate across the Sahara going from Niger to the Mediterranean coast. And they would go through the mountain passes, and they frankly didn't care to stop. A Belgian was exploring this, and he found cave paintings in the late 1950s. And so I'll show you some of them, three of them, and you can appreciate quality. And I won't speak too much on it. It'll be kind of a blank on the tape. I just want you to appreciate some of these images from one of the most remote and archaic sites on Earth. Now we're going to leap over thousands of years to modern abstract art. This unfortunately is in upside down and makes it more abstract than it need be. I hope I haven't gotten them all in upside down. Shouldn't be. It should be, right? We leap from Tassili d'Angers to Georges Braque. Oh, I see what's happened here. Let's just do this. just a vase with flowers, characteristic Braque style. This was done in the late 20s. This is also abstract. There are still imagery which you can, quote, recognize, quote, identify. Identify in the sense of match up with nature. But it is abstract. Here's a Braque work from the early 1940s. Blue pitcher. Now, Braque's abstraction still has a kind of a bridging imagery. When we go to Paul Klee, his abstraction is more intense. The imagery link is still there in Klee, only the link is in feeling. This person is having a problem, a big problem themselves. And though the work is not very large, and though it doesn't seem to have much complication, it is extremely poignant. Notice the quality of abstract art. Here's a more famous Paul Klee, given the whimsical title Sinbad the Sailor. I'm sorry the colors are washing out. It's all in deep blues and lavenders. Probably the Kandinsky colors will, well, that comes through a little bit better. This is one of Kandinsky's last works, done in 1944. It bears the title Tempered Elan. One of the most poignant, ill-informed yet poignant comments about Kandinsky's late work was that it looks like amoebic structure. And indeed, it's like interior amoeba, like that level of interior of going to the bedrock, going to the core, going to the very elements that build up the organic interior. And it's a tribute to Kandinsky's power of penetration to go that deep inside, that basic inside. By 1944, Kandinsky had been doing this for over 30 years with extraordinary dedication. He taught at the Bauhaus for 8 years. He was able discursively to present himself. This Kandinsky I show especially because the original is at the in Pasadena at the Norton Simon Museum, Weighty Circles. Now, the way in which abstract art, especially in the capable hands of Braque or Klee or Kandinsky, is able to present rather than represent, is a monumental difference. A mimesis, a representation, is usually an image base that has that natural reference. And usually is a mythic activity. But the presentation, which has the self as a reference, is a memorative activity, mnemonic. It involves something else. And Kandinsky's work, Klee's work, Braque's work cues in your self-presence for it to operate, for it to be there. Towards the end of this year, we're going to get to science. And we have to understand in a very peculiar way that in the late 20th century, the early 21st century now, in some areas already, that science has come into this abstract art realm. This, on one level, is an image of worlds. But the fact is that this is not just an image alone, it is an image of the rings of Saturn from Voyager. They do not have that color. That color is put in by computer. This is a very complex image. It's not a representation of nature. It's a presentation of man's experience of nature, which is totally different. Totally different. And to remember that, to be conscious of that expanded, amplified context, is one of the, well, privileges, I call it. It's also one of the duties that we have. This is an unprocessed image. This is what it would be without the color processing. And you can see with the planet that it shows up more. Even at that, it's a staggering image. But now let's take nature in terms of just image slices, so-called, and let's step it up. Remember now, there is no way that the human eye can see this naturally. This is all digitally processed through computers and high techniques done at JPL over here in Pasadena. To mistake this for a natural image is very serious miscalculation. It's not a natural image at all. Is in fact a creative image working towards a higher level of artistic person, maybe, higher level of civilization. Quantum jump from where we are now. Unbelievable. Coming out of the caves, about that level of jump, just around the corner. Let's look at some other images. This is the great spiral in Andromeda. About the time that we were being born is the first time that anything like this was ever recognized, ever understood for the first time. This is a whole galaxy, as big as the Milky Way galaxy that we inhabit, 2 million light years away. Again, this is not an image. This is not a part of a new image base for a new mythology. I know that sounds good. And I know it sounds especially good because beautiful people like Joseph Campbell say things like this. It is a miscalculation of enormous import to think in those terms. That's not it at all. This is a whole different level of reality. This is an abstract memory-based cosmic vision that presages a new person, new level of person, if you have to think that way. This unfortunately doesn't carry through so well. This is another galaxy, a mysterious kind of a vision set edge on. I wanted to just bring some mysterious images here, which are not images from nature, but they're part of a new creative matrix of spiritual person making, which is on a whole other level. The Trifid Nebula. Mysterious images, which are not just images. The Great Nebula in Lyra. Do they occur in nature? Notice here that there is a surreality. The nature that they occur in has no way to juxtapose itself with the nature of man as he has been. It's only because man has transformed and amplified himself unbelievably that the scale of this nature is able to be affine with him. To remember that is the most basic little bow to tie around our fingers from here on. To understand that the only way that we can be real on this context is to have made that transformation individually inside. Or to put it in a kind of a economic way, the only way to be real anymore is to earn it. By putting the work in and making that individual transformation is the only way to be real ever again. The nature that once was sufficient to be real in is cracked and blown away and gone. 100 years ago, it was already gone. The dematerialization of nature in the 19th century is the most characteristic and salient point of the development of 19th century thought. By the end of the century, Maxwell's theory of electricity and magnetism had already set the stage for Einstein a completely different sense of reality. What once was the most terrifying of all events in nature, the eclipse, the full eclipse of the sun, the blanking out of God's eye, was at one time the most terrifying aspect in nature. So that the whole development of astronomy was to try and predict eclipses to get people ready to try and understand this and prepare for it. For us today, the image of the eclipse holds no terror. Is anybody afraid here? No one here is afraid. Do you realize that we have already made that transformation? But not to live by that, by the new dimensions, is to misunderstand ourselves. We have already emotionally made that leap. We've already done that. Our problem now in this generation is consciously to remember that and not to try and forget it by pills or ignorance or innuendo, but to remember that it's all right. We belong in this larger nature. We belong here. And the last slide is the Navajo self symbol from their war ceremony. And it's the best expression from a primordial people. This was primordially in the Navajo Indians, but was drawn out by World War II. The experience of World War II for the Navajos was an incredible experience. Even though they were used to them, vast migrations. The Navajo language is Athabascan. They'd come down from southern Canada. And even though they were at home in terms of a continental sense of life, none of them had ever been over an ocean to fight in a world war. And the experience of the Navajo men in the Second World War was an incredible experience, a test of courage. And what came out of that was an archetypal, primordial self symbol, this one, that characterizes the Navajo war ceremonial, which was done first in 1941-42, about that time period. And the very first volume in the Bollingen series in 1943 was to put the art of the Navajo war ceremonial out into a portfolio book. And Bollingen series number one is that Navajo war ceremonial, which had just recently then come out. And I have a copy of it here, and you can see it before. Integrating the whole ceremonial, transforming the image base into an abstract reality, which enabled them to go from the reservation to a world war. to existentially do that task, which was psychologically horrendous for them. This was the self symbol that came out. And I'll bring out the portfolio towards the end of today, and you can see that all of the ceremony is expressed in abstract art. All of it, recognizably abstract art, on the level of Kandinsky. So it isn't just that some great artists are stepping way out ahead of everybody else, and therefore their paintings are worth 20 million or 100 million or something like that. It's a capacity which everyone has and can be evoked. And fortunately, we don't all have to go through those kinds of experiences that the individual artists or the various ethnic populations that have been yanked out of their nature, out of their history, have had to go through. So these are the slides that I have for you today. Leave the fan on. Now let me come around to the other side, and we'll get back to our more normal qualities. Sorry it took so long. I didn't realize it was going to take that long for the slides. Turn on the fan for a while. Go ahead. Oh, okay. Let me remind you that there are a couple of books that you should be reading. Kandinsky's Concerning the Spiritual in Art. Does anyone have the Dover paperback version of that here? Show the Dover paperback. Yeah, there it is. How much does it read on the back?
$2.95.
And the PRS bookstore has it, and it's generally available. So that's one of the volumes to pick up and read. The second one is any translation of Euripides' tragedy, the Bacchae. And we're going to talk more about Greek tragedy next week. Notice here that Greek tragedy is a penetration through nature. What is tragic about Greek tragedy? The tragedy is all wrapped up in what Aristotle used the term denouement. The realization that you have penetrated through the very fabric of what had been considered real. You had come to a point of hubris, was the Greek term, pride, that you were somehow exempt from karma. You're somehow exempt from nature. And the tragic denouement was that you discovered that you were not exempt at all. And to the extent that you penetrated, to that extent you were pushed back. And the tragedy is that at that focus of the action, the realization is that you are had to the extent that you thought that you were free. 2,400 years ago in classical Athens, the old Euripides, 70-some years old in exile, wrote the Bacchae because it was the swan song of the classical Greek mind. They had made the kind of penetration that we are making in the 20th century, but they could not sustain it. In Euripides' Bacchae, the whole advent of tragedy was an expression of the realization we're not going to be able to sustain. We've gone too far. And what happens to man when he goes too far? The gods get in. So that notice if you cannot sustain consciousness, it rebounds and gets wrapped up in an even more intense mythification. Mythology reabsumes you, reabsorbs you, and now you're going to pay. Now you have earned not the blessing of the gods, but the curse of the gods. So that there is this kind of perilousness, there's this kind of precariousness to the person making activity, to art, there's precariousness here. Creativity, there's a precariousness. What aspect of a human being picks up on that right away? The subconscious, feeling-toned aspect of just desserts, and sends out its little feelers, usually ahead of consciousness, usually ahead of what you're able to control, and sends back warning signals. Watch out. This is bad to do this. Little flashing danger signals. And so we shy away from consciousness on purpose, subconsciously on purpose. We don't go to the threshold. We don't penetrate through. We find a way to spin off, to enjoy a nice little touchful curlicue and come back to adjust ourselves to the old. Oh well, at least we can live. And other little platitudes like that. The precariousness is not penetrating through to the new. That's the precariousness. To recursively recoil back, but it's like the phrase, you can never go home again. You're carrying that charge. And if you go back, that transformation that should have happened for you is carried back, and that transformational energy goes into the mythic level, and it transforms and becomes tyrannical. And instead of being a level which is maternal and supports you, becomes a devouring context. This happens not only for individuals, it happens for whole populations. Nazi Germany is an exact warning signal of not making the transformation of going back and energizing the mythos, only this time the energy is all in a negative way. It's a kind of a peculiar situation. It's precarious to go on, but it is absolutely precarious to go back. And even if it's 99% precarious to go on, it's 100% precarious to go back. So the classic phrase is, at the point of consciousness of becoming a person, one has to take the chance. Even if it's just one chance, it is one chance, because going back, there is no chance whatsoever. This precariousness, this kind of sense that it's not going to work, this sense of doom, this sense of peril, which suddenly changes, the one chance in a billion suddenly happens, the snap happy ending is a characteristic of fairy tales, of the structure of fairy tales. It never happens in mythology. No myth has that experience. Every fairy tale has that experience. Tolkien, in his little essay on fairy tales, very, very wise man, says this is a peril of the soul, and that this is a triumph of the soul. and that in the scenario, it always looks darkest just before the light. It always looks most hopeless just before there's an opening. And to put it into symbolic terms,